From the Moen Broadcast Center, this is Take Two, me Martinez. In a few hours, President Trump will deliver his State of the Union address. Based on what he hears, California Attorney General Javier Becerra will give the Spanish language response.
He seems very fixated on walls and walls and walls, and so I would not be surprised if every other sentence has a wall in it somehow.
We'll hear what else Becerra has planned. That's ahead on Take Two. Stay with us.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is February 18th at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for joining us. We got a lot of great information to share with you today, so please stay with us for the whole hour. Where else would you rather be? In a few minutes, we'll check in with the U.S. Army to find out more about the military training that's happening in Los Angeles and Long Beach this week. And as the rain winds down and the sun returns,
we're already seeing substantial blooms to the east of us, areas that got a heavy drenching in October that we didn't get here in Borrego Valley.
We'll see if a wildflower superbloom might be coming to the Anza Borrego Desert this spring. First, though, President Trump delivers his second official State of the Union address tonight. Immigration is likely to be a key topic as lawmakers in Washington continue to negotiate a deal to avert another government shutdown. Now, after the president's speech, two responses, one in English, one in Spanish. Now, that practice dates back to 2011. Tonight's Spanish response will be delivered by California's first Latino Attorney General, Javier Becerra. The AG is largely seen as one of the leaders of the so-called California resistance. Becerra has taken the Trump administration to court 45 times since he was appointed to the job in 2017. We asked him earlier what he expects to hear from the president tonight.
He seems very fixated on walls and walls and walls, and so I would not be surprised if every other sentence has a wall in it somehow.
And about the importance that he sees in delivering a Spanish language rebuttal.
It's important that everyone in this country know that we are reaching out to everyone in every corner of our nation. And so to address our citizenry in both English and Spanish sends a very clear message that you aren't forgotten and you matter.
And so as we continued our conversation about the State of the Union tonight, we asked him what his views were from the state of California.
Well, you said the operative words, from California. California is number one when it comes to job creation. We're number one when it comes to high-tech jobs, to ag jobs. We're number one when it comes to manufacturing jobs. We're number one when it comes to entertainment and hospitality jobs. We're number one in graduating people from college. And we become the fifth largest economy in the world. So the fact that we're in California means that we can be optimistic about our future. We're talking about the state of the union, the entire country. And so the more that people try to do what California has successfully accomplished, the better off our country will be. And that's why I'm hoping that as a Californian, I can convey how important it is to be cutting edge, to be innovative, and to believe that if you include everyone, and that means everyone, not just those who look like you, those that sound like you, but folks who came from another country, those who look different than you, those who speak a different language. If you include everyone, your chances of having success, like California, grow. And so the message, keep going forward, keep doing what we're doing to be successful, and include everyone. It's a team effort.
But all those things that you mentioned when it comes to the positives of California's economy contribute to the overall economy of the United States. How do you see it, though, as in spite of what's going on in the rest of the country or California alone as an island?
Oh, no. California needs America the way America needs California. And so we do this together. We have the right and the liberty to do some things a little differently, but we're a unit. We're a team. That's why we're the United States of America. And as a proud Californian, I am fortunate that I can say that. But at the end of the day, I'm through and through a U.S. of A citizen, and I'm proud of it, and I hope to do everything I can to make my country better by making my state better.
Now, with that in mind, I want to focus on some of your resistance efforts. I mentioned California's 45 lawsuits against the administration. Why does it matter, from your perspective, that California be part of these legal pushbacks against the administration?
Well, and that's where I think these lawsuits prove who we are as Californians and who we hope the rest of the country will be in the future. Our lawsuits are trying to protect the gains that California has made. We're not interested in being spectators and watching someone else do things and think that that's going to be to our benefit. We have done things. We are cutting edge. We've innovated, and we want to protect that. And it's meant good-paying, high-tech jobs, clean energy jobs for California. We're not going to all of a sudden abandon that because someone thinks it's a good idea to go back to the days where you burned a lot of coal, for example. We want to do cutting edge. And so the lawsuits I've filed against the Trump administration are to protect the gains that we've made, because the Trump administration is trying to roll back all these accomplishments and innovations. It's not for California to sit and watch the federal government try to erase our gains. We're going to fight to protect them.
Well, let's talk about the cost of these fights. The 2017-2018 fiscal year, that was about $9.2 million, so the cost of the lawsuits. As of September of last year, California won around 21 of those. How would you respond to those who question whether these lawsuits are worth taxpayer money?
One lawsuit by itself that we won secured $29 million for the state of California. It was the lawsuit to protect the JAG funding that goes towards local law enforcement agencies from the federal government. $29 million was being held up by the Trump administration. We won our lawsuit. We got our $29 million. That one lawsuit has paid for not just 45 lawsuits, but it has paid for all the different lawsuits we had to file.
How is this approach not an end around the democratic process? I mean, a kind of legislation by litigation.
But we're just protecting what we have earned. We're not trying to use the courts to get us something that's not ours. Every one of these lawsuits is trying to protect something that we have earned or we have claimed, and someone is trying to take them from us. I'm not about to let that happen. In this case, the bad guy trying to take something from us is the federal government. And if we've earned it, we certainly pay taxes for it, we should get it. And you got to give me a good reason why you're going to try to snatch it away from us before we just let you do it. You know, we used to be the Wild Wild West. We used to settle these things slightly differently. Now we do them in court. But either way, my job is to protect the 40 million people of this state, our resources, and our values.
Senator Kamala Harris has announced her presidential run. Do you plan on endorsing her?
Well, I'm going to take a close look at the race. I've gotten involved in our presidential races over the last 24 years, and I intend to be active again. I think we have a great number of talented Democrats who are seeking to be our leader, and I'm looking forward to having those conversations with all of them. And some of them I know more than others, but the nice thing about all of this is that on the Democratic side, I think we have a wealth of talent, and I wouldn't be surprised if the enthusiasm going into the 2020 election is high because of the person who will be our candidate for president.
No attorney general to attorney general political love there?
I have a great relationship with Senator Harris, and she's been a fantastic leader for the state of California. And we're fortunate to be able to have someone like her launching this bid for president coming from California. And so California will be represented in this race for president. And I'm looking forward to seeing what the candidates say and do to make it clear that we're going to keep this engine rolling forward that we call the United States of America.
All right. One last thing, coming back to your response tonight. What do you hope Californians take away from your speech?
Look, there's enough good going around across the country that we don't need to hide behind falsehoods to describe the state of the union. And so I hope to be honest, candid, but strike a chord of unity where if we do this together as a team, we can keep it going. Because at the end of the day, one person doesn't make a country. It's all of us coming together that have made this the United States of America. So we're all going to have to chip in. And I hope that what we hear tonight are words that encourage everyone to chip in.
California Attorney General Javier Becerra will deliver the State of the Union response in Spanish tonight. Attorney General Becerra, thank you very much for your time.
Hey, thank you.
And just a reminder, KPCC will carry the president's speech live tonight at 6. As we heard earlier, immigration is expected to be a big part of President Trump's State of the Union address tonight. DACA recipients have been front and center in the negotiations surrounding the president's border security plan. Those are the individuals protected under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which allows undocumented youth who meet certain requirements to remain in the country and obtain a work permit. The Titan Dreamers Resource Center on the Cal State University of Fullerton campus specializes in supporting undocumented students. It's the first of its kind in the CSU system. The staff and students at the center will be watching the president's address this evening with measured expectations.
What I'm hoping to hear from President Trump in tonight's State of the Union is a willingness to truly compromise and bring this country together. The hope is that he is willing to stop using people as pawns in a game and willing to listen to the experts.
That was Martha Zavala Perez, coordinator of the Dreamers Resource Center and a DACA recipient herself. Earlier today, we asked about her expectations ahead of tonight's speech.
Like always, the worry with this president is that we don't know exactly what's going to come out. It's kind of holding your breath until he speaks and see what happens. I am afraid that he will continue to try to pit communities against one another, and that just isn't helpful for anyone.
But if the president makes the connection between DACA and the wall, Zavala Perez says it speaks more about the president's character.
Sadly, I think that his continual connection between these two shows more of his own lack of morality. The fact that someone is willing to say, I will use a human as a negotiation tool, is truly despicable and not something that our country stands for.
That was DACA recipient Martha Zavala Perez, who is also coordinator of the Dreamers Resource Center. Staying with immigration, the Trump administration has been saying for some time that it wants to reduce immigration court backlogs and speed up deportation cases. But as KPCC's Leslie Berstein-Rojas reports, the recent partial government shutdown has had the opposite effect.
The downtown L.A. immigration court on Olive Street sat closed for 5 weeks. The day after it reopened last week, I met immigration attorney Richard Lucero downstairs. He just wrapped up his first hearing since the shutdown. I asked him how it went.
Today I proceeded with my case. It was just on a status conference. The only difference is that the government didn't have a file. The judges had their files. The governments didn't have their files. So they're still under a little bit of, obviously, a disadvantage.
The nation's immigration courts are still reeling from the shutdown. When courts reopened, more cases had to be continued. Government case files stored off-site weren't there because no one had been around to order them. Judges who were furloughed hadn't had time to review cases. Interpreters who have to be booked in advance were scarce. And there's still no telling when tens of thousands of canceled hearings will be rescheduled. All this against a pre-existing backlog of more than 75,000 pending deportation cases in L.A. alone.
The shutdown was a huge, huge impediment to being able to complete cases.
That's immigration judge Ashley Tabador, who heads the judges' union and works in the L.A. court.
Over 80,000 cases or hearings for those cases were canceled during the shutdown, which means every one of those cases are going to be continued. The shutdown was the worst thing that you could do for speeding up the process.
Deportation cases that are set for trial require preparation, like the one Tabador had the first day court reopened.
I just frankly told the people I don't have the ability to go forward today because I haven't been able to read the 500 pages of filings that had been made in the case. And neither had the government. The government attorney didn't even know what the case was about.
So the case was continued, joining those that were held up during the shutdown. A spokesman for the federal agency that oversees the immigration court says people whose hearings were canceled will receive notices in the mail with a new court date. When is not clear. Just a few months ago, former Attorney General Jeff Sessions called on immigration judges to work through cases much more quickly. That was before President Trump's showdown with Congress over a border wall. Here again is Richard Lucero, the immigration attorney.
It's a little bit contrary to his order if the government is shutting down, and because of this, these cases are not going to be delayed for years and years.
Lucero says in a lot of cases, canceling a hearing can benefit the person the government wants to deport.
If you don't have a very strong case here in the immigration court, that could be for a variety of reasons. Obviously, it would benefit you to delay your case as much as possible, let's just say, hoping for a different administration.
But he adds that people with strong cases who've spent months and years waiting for a hearing have been deeply hurt. Like Zulema Pacheco, a Salvadoran asylum seeker. She waited 2 years for a hearing that was set for January 9th. She had to appear in court to seek a work permit. Pacheco says she's upset by the delay. She was hoping to earn a better living while her case plays out. Right now, she and her young son are camped out with her mom in El Sereno, all sharing a room. She has no idea when she'll get another hearing date. Ashley Tabador, the immigration judge, says the focus right now is to get the courts fully up to speed to deal with scheduled hearings. After that will come the thousands that were canceled.
That may take months before those cases can be reviewed and put back on the calendar and reevaluated as to what final hearing date they're going to get.
It's not clear how much time the immigration courts will have to get things back to normal. Trump has threatened another government shutdown if he doesn't get money for a border wall. Covering immigration, I'm Leslie Beristein Rojas.
Here in LA, there are a lot of options for Filipino food. So many great ones that it can actually be a little intimidating to know where to start. With that in mind, we've got our food editor to help us out with a starting point, which turned out to be in a really grand central spot in the city. Find out where when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. A lot of Angelenos were surprised to hear military helicopters flying over downtown LA last night, but it's nothing to be concerned about. The helicopters are part of U.S. Army training exercises that started last night and will run through Saturday in Los Angeles and Long Beach. They're intended to, quote, enhance soldier skills by operating in various urban environments and settings, according to a U.S. Army media statement. For more details, we reached out to Lieutenant Colonel Lauren Beimer about an hour ago. He's a spokesman for the U.S. Army Special Operations Command. He says the military routinely trains in a variety of cities across the United States using urban environments that are not easily recreated. The U.S. Army has previously trained in Miami, Boston, New York, Las Vegas, and Dallas because, he says, the military does not know where the next battlefield is going to be. Baghdad and Ramadi, both in Iraq, are areas where the U.S. military has engaged in urban combat. So training in cities such as Los Angeles ensures the U.S. military is ready and able to defend the nation. All right, moving on. The University of California at Berkeley is experimenting with an unusual solution to the student housing crisis. It's matching graduate students looking for affordable housing with senior citizens who have space in their homes. As part of our California Dream collaboration, Cal Matters' Felicia Mello reports.
About a dozen graduate students gather in a meeting room on the UC Berkeley campus. They're here to learn about a new way to get cheaper housing, living with retired UC employees. It's called home sharing, and it's an idea more campuses around the country are experimenting with as homeowners age and students struggle with rising rents. For senior homeowners, the selling point is extra income and companionship.
People want to continue living in their homes, and people are living longer and retiring later.
Andy Gaines is the executive director of Ashby Village, a nonprofit that partnered with UC Berkeley's Retirement Center to launch the pilot program.
Oftentimes, as people retire from the workforce and their friends or family die or move away, they are left more isolated.
For grad students, the attraction is below market rent. In Berkeley, that means under $1,000 a month for a room in a shared home. A pretty sweet deal in one of the country's most expensive housing markets. Alyssa Mathewitz is a PhD student in metabolic biology.
I thought the program was really awesome because housing is just so hard to get for an affordable price.
She's currently spending about $1,500 for a room in a house near campus. Home sharing would lower her costs, but she says that's not the only draw.
It would be great on our end, too, to get to learn more about the university and what it was maybe like back then when they were working there.
Students and retirees who want to home share need to pass a background check. What happens next is kind of like a dating service. Homeowners read students' profiles and decide who they want to meet. When a match is made, the two sign a home sharing agreement, outlining things like who will clean the bathroom and whether the student can have overnight guests. Similar programs are underway at Humboldt State and New York University. The Berkeley organizers hope to make at least 6 matches by February. But convincing retirees to open their homes might not be an easy sell.
And can I get anything to drink?
Ed Vine is a former scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. He and his wife have been hosting her 19-year-old cousin at their home in the Berkeley Hills. It's not part of the UC Berkeley program, just a short-term arrangement while she figures out what she wants to do with her life.
We didn't know what she was like, what she was thinking.
Ed says overall it's turned out well, but there have been a few hiccups. For one, she takes really long showers. Ed studies energy efficiency and notices.
We had to tell her, try to shorten your showers.
His wife likes the extra company, but when Ed got an email inviting him to sign up for Berkeley's home sharing program, he wasn't sure.
For me, I'd like having it just my wife and myself.
Organizers hope that focusing on graduate students will make home sharing appeal to more homeowners. They're seen as more studious than undergrads, more responsible. Volunteer mediators will help the new housemates sort out any disagreements. If the program is successful, it could expand to other UC campuses. In Berkeley, I'm Felicia Mello.
The largest population of Filipinos in the United States call Los Angeles home. LA's food editor Alina Shatkin headed to Grand Central Market to talk about it with her friend Karen Tongson, who was the first person to introduce her to Filipino cuisine. They met up at Sari Sari, inspired by convenience stores in the Philippines that have small portable restaurants attached to them. Here's Alina.
All right, what are you taking a bite of first, Karen?
You know, I feel like because the halo halo is time sensitive, we should totally dive into it right now.
Do because, it. You got the first bite.
So halo halo is a Filipino dessert that's a cross between what you're used to seeing as a kind of shaved ice dish, maybe in some of the Korean restaurants, with the milk component, crushed ice, and there are lots of little bits that you mix up with it, including often kind of little red beans or jellied fruit. And this right here seems to have actually a kind of pineapple slushy in it. And a big dollop of beautiful vanilla ice cream on top. The thing with the approach to halo halo is, you have to decide if you're going to try to plunge through the different disparate layers or if you're going to mix it first. Because halo halo means mix.
Oh, pass it over this way. I got to try some.
Mm.
You know, the thing I like about eating halo halo is that I always feel kind of like a geologist. Like, I'm excavating different stratospheres of, this is the stalactite era. It had custard. This is the, the fresh fruit era. This is the slushy era.
See, I always feel like we have to eat around the top a little bit and then start mushing it in and then getting the whole mixed aspect of it together. It's often not a very elegant thing to try to eat with people. Actually, it's a lot of fun. Like, a lot of kids love just punching their spoons in it and, getting messy and getting sticky.
Yeah.
All right, shall we dive into some other stuff?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's get into that lechon.
Look at the beautiful chunks of pork belly. See that little fine layer of fat right there in the middle? It's not too much. It's not too gelatinous. It's just going to be enough to give us that punch of moisture. And look at how beautiful the crackling is here. It's brown, a kind of nice golden brown with little bits of crackled skin. To me, this feels luxurious. Even though you can pick up like lechon kawali in a lot of mom and pop duro duro joints, like point joints, these cafeteria style Filipino places, but there's something really super elegant and luxurious to the way that you could just get a plate of this for frickin' lunch, you know, in the middle of like a, you know, Grand Central Market, you can have something this good.
My name is Margarita Mansky. I'm owner of Sari Sari store in Grand Central Market, Los Angeles.
Well, tell us a little bit about the menu. I mean, there's so much in Filipino cuisine. What kind of dishes specifically did you want to focus on?
Well, what we had in mind was silog. I don't know if you're familiar with that concept where you put an egg on anything. That's what we had in mind because we felt that it was approachable to everybody, because who doesn't? I mean, most people love an egg on top, like a runny egg on top of protein and rice. And, you know, other Filipino dishes are good, but not as approachable. So that's why we chose this concept.
So for years and years, I would always read the stories, Filipino is the hot new cuisine, you know, and then finally in the past couple of years, it really seems like it has arrived and it hit the mainstream. Mm-hmm. This and many other restaurants, Lhasa, also, you know, Mam Sur, a lot of great restaurants here in LA. How do you feel about being part of this sort of wave of I guess it's, I mean, you've been cooking for a long time, so it's not really new, but, you know, it's a new wave to a lot of people.
No, for sure. And I feel like you mentioned Lhasa and Mam Sur. Charles Olalia, they were actually the first ones who probably started this wave of Filipino cooking and all that. It just really organically happened for us. And it was just perfect timing because it was the time when all these places were like opening up and you know, getting attention and all that. So
talk to me about the Holo Holo, because I think for many Americans, like, you know, many of the other dishes, they're more recognizable and accessible, rice, meat, egg, right? But the Holo Holo, there's really no, you know, comparison in like American cuisine to anything like it. And I feel like it's the one thing that kind of blows people's minds the most when they try Filipino cuisine and they haven't had a lot of it. Whoa, tell me about it. What's in yours?
Well, Holo Holo doesn't really make any sense.
It's so true. You can have such a very precise preference for it. So I guess it's whatever you like goes in there.
Exactly. And I kind of wanted to do something that and put stuff that I like to eat in it instead of like the beans, which I don't like. So, and then plus adapting to what we have here in the States. I mean, we got in California and Los Angeles, we got great produce, strawberries, all the berries, all the, you know, peaches when it's in season, mangoes when it's in season. So just kind of taking that and making it a little more approachable to people.
Well, thank you so much for walking us through great food at Sari Sari.
Yes, thank you for coming.
Well, Karen, you were the person who introduced me to Filipino food when I first moved to LA, and you showed me the joys of lumpia and pork, mm-hmm. and a lot of very delicious things. And I think for me, the real revelation, although I wouldn't have maybe been able to articulate it at the time, was that balance of sweet and tart, that acidic and sweetness that I feel like is so specific to Filipino cuisine. Well, I mean, other Asian cuisines too, but there's a particular flavor I associate with Filipino cuisine.
It's that trinity of soy, garlic, vinegar with like a hint of sweetness to it. I think, you know, people have been tasting that flavor profile for a long time with Filipino food here, and especially in LA, but I think that it's just coming to the fore now that flavor profile belongs to a kind of Filipino flavor profile.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you came of age, you grew up here in Southern California, in the Inland Empire, and you've seen Filipino cuisine become suddenly this hot thing. But, you know, it's supposedly been becoming a hot thing for many years now.
It's so funny because I have, like, this searing memory of these kids making fun of me for my mom making this beautiful stew called caldereta, which is basically a meat stew with like kind of like olives and peas in it. So the kids, it was like my 12th birthday or something, and all the kids were calling it like dog food because it looked like Alpo. Terrible. Children can be so cruel sometimes. But it's so going from that like end of that kind of immigrant experience around one's food to then having every major media outlet in the country, and at this point internationally, talking about Filipino food as being the new thing, the it thing of the moment, is really kind of stunning. One of the things that the new chefs have been doing is actually to really stick to these flavors that are memory triggers, that kind of activate your sense of the food that you've eaten from, you know, back home or from like your household where your mom or grandma make it. And they don't leave those elements behind. They don't entirely obliterate that aspect of Filipino cuisine. Instead, they just kind of translate it into these vehicles that people don't feel completely alienated by.
Well, Karen Tongson, thank you so much for eating here with us at Sorry Sorry Store in the Grand Central Market and for sharing your love and knowledge of Filipino cuisine.
It's always my pleasure to eat with you, Lena, and I'm always happy to try any new Filipino joint in town with you any day.
That was LA's food editor Alina Shatkin and Karen Tongson, who first introduced her to Filipino food. Want some Filipino options? Yeah, you do. Check out LAist.com for a list. That's LAIST.com. California's getting more dependent on electricity than ever before, and I'm talking beyond turning on your bedroom light when you get up in the morning. We've got devices that turn on other devices, and all of them rely on electricity. That means we rely a lot more on the state's energy grid, which one expert claims is always being hacked. Coming up, find out how Californians could be held hostage and in the dark. That's ahead when Take Two continues.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, offering an online hybrid format in West LA, with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start September. Apply by February 18th to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. We depend on electricity to power our lives, but as much as we take it for granted, it's not entirely reliable. Take the recent storms. Tens of thousands of people across the state lost power at different points this week. There's also the risk of cyber attacks. Julie Cart has been reporting about the vulnerability of the state's energy grid for the online news site Cal Matters. Julie, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
All right. Let's talk cybersecurity first. You talked to a VP of a company that oversees the state's grid, and he said, quote, and I guess I shouldn't be that surprised, but he said, quote, we're always being attacked. Can you elaborate on what he's talking about?
It's not like there's enemies at the gate, guys with guns outside. It's the new world. It is hackers, cyber attackers trying to get into their computer system so that they can do some mischief.
So what mischief is this?
5 years ago, it would have been ransomware. We're going to get in here. We're going to be able to turn off the lights unless you pay us X amount of money. It would have been surfing around, trying to get customers' private information, that sort of thing. Now it is, we have the capacity to turn off power to a city, a state, a neighborhood. This happened with Russia hacking Ukraine's grid so that it could look like a destabilized country so that Russia would be a better place for foreign companies or international companies to be based. The worst case or the nefarious scenario is folks come in, terrorists in the way that we think of them, destabilize, turn off the lights, incapacitate a city like Los Angeles. There's chaos for a certain amount of time, and that is the softening so that a more conventional attack can be launched.
So lawmakers, this concerns lawmakers. It should concern everyone, but concerns lawmakers. How vulnerable do they say the state's power system is to hackers?
It's the kind of thing that you know it's being taken care of, but it's not front of mind because the hallmark of people who run security is that they don't talk about it.
Right,
they say, trust me, we're handling it. So I think more and more with the vulnerability of the grid being exposed by fire, earthquake, storms, if you've mentioned, I mean, a tree limb can do tremendous damage. So I think this is more front of mind for them in the holistic way that the grid and utilities are being scrutinized now in Sacramento. This will be part of the conversation.
But PG&E, SoCal Edison, they're private companies. I'm wondering what power the state has to monitor these security systems.
The state has a lot of power. I mean, in some ways, it's frustrating for consumers because it seems like these guys do whatever they want. Yeah. But they're a regulated monopoly. So they report to the Public Utilities Commission. They have to present their plans for fire mitigation, for security, for lots of things. And it always has considered cybersecurity, but that it's taking a higher priority now.
Great to hear.
Good news. I'm here to help.
But I gotta tell you something. As I was reading your article and I was thinking about it, I was like, it is a little frightening to know that a team of people with a laptop in another country can hack in and have that much control over something we use and rely on so much each and every day. I mean, should we be a little freaked out here?
Actually, the scariest thing to me in all of that was it's not someone busting down your door. It's someone lurking. Someone can get the credentials or sign-on material from an employee who was a little careless. They can plant these bots that sit there.
Yeah.
They get to know and understand a system, understand the security, and just sit there. And they can be called upon. They're sleepers.
Wow.
When they attack or when they want to launch something, they say, okay, and we'll activate all these different sleepers. And it can come from multiple sources. So it becomes difficult. It can be my computer. It can be KPCC's computer. It can be Edison's. It can be anything. And then they activate them all at once. And it, next thing you know, it's a multi-pronged attack, and you cannot figure out where it came from.
Now, wondering, is there anything one person can do, or are we at the whim of the decisions made by lawmakers and the utility companies on this?
We can do what we should do all the time as citizens. We can pay attention. No sense getting hysterical about it. The one thing that all the security people I talked to said to me, are any of your passwords the same? Of course, they're all the same. Is it your dog's name and your children's birthday and all that kind of thing? We need to pay a lot of attention to that kind of thing. It's sort of a drone in our ear, but it is really, really serious. And that's our general concern in this world about our intellectual property and people stealing our identity. When it comes to security of the grid, those poor people who work in those companies, they're swiping cards, they're walking,
Wow. Now, another risk to the state's electric grid, parts, just plain old. What does aging infrastructure mean for the security of the system?
I read a statistic that something like 70% of the poles and wires and transformers in the United States are from the 60s. And there are pieces of the electric grid across the country that were in place when Thomas Edison was creating or expanding electricity and our use of it. This is huge. It is like all of infrastructure, which we tend to think of as roads and bridges and things like that. The electricity grid is part of it. It's very vulnerable. It's very touchy. Things are old. You look at them sideways and they can explode. I mean, this is obviously an overstatement, but that infrastructure really, really is crying out for huge investment, billions and billions of dollars. And one of the things that's being discussed by both the utilities in the state and the state itself is before you change that infrastructure to new, until you put in position the new grid, we need to figure out what that is. Digital, interconnected, and smart. So the interim changes and updates, it's possible they've been put on hold because they know they're going to make that giant leap.
I'm talking about the vulnerability of the state's energy grid with Julie Card from Cal Matters. There's Mother Nature, heavy rains, winds, extreme heat, wildfires, that all poses problems. What's the pace at which utilities are upgrading the infrastructure to withstand all this?
They're moving very fast. A lot of it is armoring. So they take electric transmission lines and they sheathe them in more insulation so they can withstand the tree branch that flies. The poles now are being changed out from wooden to composite materials. Very, very expensive, extremely time consuming. There's a discussion about burying lines, which isn't always the thing that protects them, but that's some estimates, $3 million a mile, and there's 200,000 miles of transmission lines. So there's a lot going on, and fire is driving a big part of the conversation, how to make them more safe.
And I forgot to add those little critters, the squirrels.
Squirrels.
They eat through all kinds of stuff.
Squirrels, rats, swans. I mean, there are a lot of people who say, look, people like me are being hysterical about hacking as far as bringing down the grid, when you, if you do the sums, it's really animals that have created most damage. Good, it's a good argument right now.
Now, we're talking about all this protection that we need to have for the electric grid. What about the cost of all this? Because I'm wondering, is this all going to come down on you, me, and everyone listening to pay for all this stuff?
No, big companies are going to absorb the costs and protect the ratepayers. And I'm smiling broadly because that's not going to happen. Never, ever will that happen. Major utilities are critical to the infrastructure and the running of the state, obviously. Too big to fail, kind of. And they are allowed and every day go to the Public Utilities Commission and say, we did this thing. And it's an onerous cost. We must pass that on to the ratepayers. And it doesn't seem so horrible because there are so many of us. When you have 16 million people absorbing the cost of a multi-billion dollar project, it's cents, it's pennies. But nothing that is happening now will be paid for by the companies. It will all be paid for by us. A lot of security.
That's Julie Cart, reporter for Cal Matters, talking about how vulnerable California's electric grid is to outside threats, including extreme weather and cyber attacks. Julie, thanks a lot.
Pleasure.
Bad weather can be a knock on our electric grid, but there may be a more colorful upside to all this rain. Scientists and nature enthusiasts are buzzing about another possible superbloom. That's an explosion of wildflowers beyond what's typically expected. California's last superbloom was 2 years ago in the spring of 2017 and drew tourists from all over the country. The reason for that superbloom was steady rain showers drenching the desert valleys at about 150% more than normal, which is similar to what's been happening more recently.
We've had a good amount so far. It's looking very promising. As of today, we've had a little over 4 inches.
That was Jim Dice. He manages the Steele Bernand Anza Borrego Desert Research Center. Dice has been overseeing that area since 2012 and is monitoring the current rainfall for its wildlife. He says the sparse valleys and mountains of the Anza Borrego Desert were transformed in 2017 with vibrant orange, bright yellow, and deep violet wildflowers. And those flowers are already making early appearances in the valley's nearby areas.
We're already seeing substantial blooms to the east of us, areas that got a heavy drenching in October that we didn't get here in Borrego Valley. Right now, people are seeing a lot of sand verbena, which is a really showy purplish pink flower that everybody loves to see.
And more flowers are expected. But Dice advises that you hold off on planning your trip to the potential super bloom, which typically happens in March. There's a chance the bloom will be thwarted by environmental factors.
The only possible hitches at this point are if it gets too hot too soon, that could cause a smaller bloom. We're still fighting an invasive species that tends to wipe out the native wildflowers, a plant called Sahara mustard. But the park and the community have done a great job controlling it here in the valley.
But Dice says there is reason to hope for a stunning show of flowers from recent rains.
Just based on the amount of germination and young plants I'm seeing all over the hillside. So, you know, a little bit more rain and followed by some nice sunshiny days would trigger a very similar response.
So if you happen to be traveling near Borrego Springs in a few months, go check it out. Housekeeping is typically very hard work, many times with low pay. Many women turn to that job to make ends meet. Coming up, we'll hear from one who did just that, but she also earned her college degree and wrote a book she titled Made: Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. Hear her story next. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. About 300,000 people in L.A. work as housekeepers, childcare workers, and home health care aides. Now, that's according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The work is often backbreaking and frequently underpaid, but the people who work these jobs don't often have the opportunity to share their stories with a larger audience. One new book chronicles the tale of one such woman working in Montana. Here's her story.
My name is Stephanie Land, and I'm the author of Made, Hard Work, Low Pay, and A Mother's Will to Survive. The title Made just comes from the job that I was doing and the name that I was called left on notes for me in people's houses and was often not my own name, but just to the maid. I definitely did not choose to be a maid. I was a maid because I had no other choice. It was the height of the recession, and I did not have a college degree. I didn't have any professional experience. What happened was I found myself with a child to care for on my own, and I started applying for jobs. And as soon as I told them that I needed to work during daycare hours, my work hours were suddenly limited, and a lot of the entry-level positions were already taken by people who had been laid off recently. The book essentially is about this welfare cliff that we have created for people, especially single mothers. A single mother making $10 an hour and receiving government assistance, like SNAP or housing assistance or Medicaid or whatever, she would have to go from making $10 an hour and jump all the way to $33 an hour to make up for the amount of money that she was receiving in resources. The company that I worked for, they charged their clients, you know, anywhere from $20 to $25 an hour, but they paid me an hourly rate that wasn't even half that. I started at, you know, just above minimum wage, I think, and by the time I left 2 years later, I was up to $9.25. I mean, realizing I made so little kind of made me realize that I needed to do something else. It was pretty recently that I went off food stamps. I think it was the beginning of 2016. I wanted the freedom to be able to go to the grocery store and not buy something with my EBT card and not be judged for that. But that didn't necessarily mean that I'd never went hungry after that. So it wasn't like I broke out of poverty or I was suddenly free from it. I was still living in low-income housing. My kids were still on Medicaid or qualified for it. It was just kind of this gradual thing that I did. I personally knew that I wanted to be a writer at age 10. I had a teacher, his name was Mr. Birdsall, and he forced us to keep a journal. And at first I absolutely hated it, and it was just this like awful assignment. But then I just absolutely loved it. And I was a daily writer for a good part of my life in journals. I also have a condition called scoliosis, and at one point I lost the ability to hold a pen because I had a lot of nerve damage in my right arm. And a friend suggested I start a WordPress blog type of website. Every once in a while, I would write something that was kind of neat and a little beautiful, and I would share it on Facebook, and people started sharing my writing. I was at the University of Montana in Missoula, and they have an amazing creative writing program. And so I took advantage of that, basically. I went to every writing workshop that I could, and that was when I first started writing about being a maid, and then eventually sold an essay that I'd written in college to Vox, and that essay went extremely viral. And that's how I got the book deal out of that. I've been hearing from like 20 to 50 people a day recently just sharing their stories and saying, your story is almost exactly like my story, only my daughter is named Molly. I'm really hoping that the more people who connect with this story in some way, either like universally with the parenting thing or the work involved or the discrimination or the stigmas around EBT cards, that the less stigmas that will be wrapped around all of those things and the less shame and blame there will be placed on people in situations where they're struggling to get by.
That was former house cleaner Stephanie Land talking about her new memoir, Made: Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. All right, you can always find us on Twitter. We're at Take Two, at Take Two. Send us any message you want. We'll all obsess over it after the show. And you can find me, Twitter, and Instagram at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2:00.